finally getting to an episode that we have been looking forward to for a long, long time. Today, we're doing banned books. That's right. U2, Aerosmith, the story of the Talking Heads, the Rolling Stones.
What are you talking about, Ben?
Noel, I'm talking about today's episode,
banned books. I see what you did there.
I had to get rid of this joke immediately.
Ben, you're a fool. I love you.
Welcome to Ridiculous History, folks. We promise that the rest of the jokes you will hear will be at least better than the one we opened with.
That's how you do it. You set the bar low, and then everything is just cake after that. Everything is just bonus icing.
That's the way you and I approach a lot of things, man.
Bonus icing.
Yes. And speaking of bonuses, we are, as always, immensely privileged to have our super producer, Casey Pegram, with us today. And, you know, jokes aside, this is a fascinating episode, and this is a little bit like a list for us.
Yeah, sort of a listicle. What does a list make? Three?
Three is the minimum number required to make a list, which is a rule I agree with, but I just made up back in our YouTube video days.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, we would have to have shows that were list-based.
Right.
And there would be things where, you know, five is a great number for a list.
Yeah.
But three is the minimum.
Three is the minimum. It almost is like, you didn't want to go the extra mile and do an even four? The answer to that today, my friends, is no. We've got a solid three.
We've got a solid three. We've got some other things that might interest you. And this episode is kind of inspired by our earlier discussion, previous episode, on the dilemma of progress versus preservation.
It's true.
So we're talking about these books that have been suppressed or yanked out of popular society.
Literally, physically yanked out of children's hands at times.
Yes.
You know, by constables or something. I don't know.
Right. And now
the book police.
The book police. God, I hope they're real. Wait, no, because I know what's going to happen in this episode. No, they are real and I don't like it.
You don't want it. You don't want that. You don't want none of that.
Thank you for saving me there, Noel.
Keep your books, man.
Got to keep them. So usually when we think of books being banned, we think of, you know, fictional things like The Catcher in the Rye. Yeah,
To Kill a Mockingbird is one that comes up. And, you know, it's still taught in school, but it is one that some schools are uncomfortable with.
Right, exactly. But what we're looking at today is the other side of the genre equation. You see, it's not just fictional books that get banned, burned, or pulled from the market.
Yeah, and you could argue that this is, you know, more important in many ways than banning works of fiction, which obviously are culturally valuable. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about hard stuff here, hard science fact.
Yes, yes, things that literally changed our understanding of the world.
Although to this day, some of these books are still looked at askance by many. We're going to get into that too.
Oh yes, yes. And we have a great example of reference that you found that we are going to have to put in at some point in the episode.
Oh yeah, it's going to be fun. It's a, we're going to have a musical guest.
Yeah, we're going to have a musical guest. It's going to be not the first time, but one of the most enjoyable / disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
So, who do we have first? The first banned book. Well, it was written by a fellow named Galileo Galilei.
You ever heard that song by the Indigo Girls?
I love it. I was thinking of it as we were going in today.
ATL, Hometown Heroes. It's like Galileo something, something, something. Yeah. Over a couple of beers. How long till my soul gets it right? That's all I know.
Can any human being ever reach that kind of life?
Ben!
Right?
Beautiful singing voice.
Wow. Yeah, oh, my God. Thank you.
Well, it's cool. It's an interesting... they do a good job of sort of personifying the quandary that Galileo faced because he was an innovator. He thought big. He had big ideas.
Yes.
And that was not particularly popular with many of the folks in power, especially the church, because we're talking about the Copernican view of the solar system, right?
Yes, yes. Heliocentrism, the radical notion that despite the spiritual implications, the earth revolved around the sun rather than the sun and all things revolving around Earth.
Now, I'm a little foggy about why that being the Ptolemaic model, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why does one or the other imply more or less of a god?
So the controversy from a spiritual sense is that Earth and humanity are the protagonist of the universe.
Got it.
They're the main characters.
That makes sense.
You know?
Yeah.
So there's
sort of the way a child thinks.
Probably, right. Or many adults.
Yeah, that's true.
But the thing that was interesting about this as well is that other astronomers, not just, you know, spiritual leaders, but other astronomers tried to find what they felt were quantitative arguments against heliocentrism. But his book, The Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems, Ptolemaic and Copernican, was a little too solid to be taken down just by attempts at rebuttal arguments.
It's true. And the Spanish Inquisition gets into this game pretty quick, right? In 1611, they kind of caught wind of Galileo and him espousing these Copernican views. But they sort of, you know, kept their distance. They didn't come a-gunning for him right away. And he was allowed, even, he had pals in the papacy, in the Vatican, who kind of gave him some leeway, I guess. They allowed him to espouse these views as long as he couched them as being mathematical theories, which is a theme that comes into play with some of our other list entries, right?
Yeah, they micromanaged the pants off this guy. He originally intended to title this work Dialogue on the Two Chief World Systems, The Dialogue on the Ebb and Flow of the Sea, but the Inquisition made him remove the reference to tides in the title.
This is 20 years later, too. They'd known about him since the early 1600s.
They had their eye on him, yeah.
They had their eye on him, and they're like, all right, let's see what this rabble-rouser gets up to. Then in 1616, he kept having complaints filed against him.
Right.
For his views and for him, his willingness to openly speak about this and to publish these works. And he finally had a complaint lodged against him, a written complaint with the Inquisition, specifically against Galileo's Copernican views, and Galileo responded by defending his views to a person by the name of Monsignor Piero Dini, who was an official at the Vatican. And then he also wrote his famous letter to the Grand Duchess Christina, basically saying, come on, I'm just asking questions here. You know, I should be free to explore the meaning of the universe and existence without you meddling in my affairs, you know? Get out of my face, Rome.
Right. And let's dive into a little bit of this here. So earlier, Pope Urban VIII had himself asked Galileo to argue for and against heliocentrism.
Because they were kind of personal friends-ish,
they were in contact.
As much as you can be with a pope.
Right. He asked him to put these arguments in the book and to be careful not to advocate heliocentrism.
Right.
Sort of pull a mainstream news thing, present both sides of the argument.
Exactly.
And he asked for another favor, and he said, hey, Galileo, can you put my personal views about this in the book? And Galileo did, but the problem is that the presenter of the geocentric view, that Earth is the middle of everything, the defender of that in the book is a guy named Simplicio, not the most complimentary name. And
he's some sort of simp?
Yeah, he comes off like a
adult?
Yes, a dunderhead. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a nincompoop.
Got it.
And Galileo takes the things that Pope Urban says and puts them in Simplicio's voice.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Pope feels publicly ridiculed and is no longer a fan of Galileo G. So Galileo gets called to Rome to defend his controversial writings. He arrives in February of 1633, and he is brought to the inquisitors.
Yeah, and let's also just point out that about a decade prior, in 1616, he was formally accused of heresy.
Yes.
Already.
Yeah.
So he was not, you know, the fact that he was buddies with Pope Urban probably is what got his butt out of the frying pan a time or two. But now he is literally pissed off the one guy that was going to help him, you know, dodge the Inquisitors. And you know no one expects the Spanish Inquisition. Right?
We made it. We made it.
It happened.
Yeah. He had a past. And, Noel, I think you put it very well when you talk about how he's almost always skirting by.
Yep.
Just on the edge. And when it all comes to a head— in 1630s, right? In 1633?
That's right.
He is interrogated. He's like 70 at this point. He's interrogated for 18 days straight. They eventually say, look, we're going to torture you if you don't tell us what we
want to
hear.
Well, it's like, what do they want him to say? I mean, as they want him to confess to what exactly? He's a scientist. Like, he didn't do, I don't understand. I think they just wanted him to renounce his views. I think that's what they were after, right? They wanted him to print a retraction.
Yeah, he was specifically required in the sentence they delivered on June 22nd of 1633. He was required to abjure, curse, and detest his heliocentric opinions.
That's right. They were basically saying that he had made too strong a case for the Copernican view of the solar system.
And so what's the outcome here, right? He's alienated the Pope. He's no longer under his protection. He does get this sentence. They tell him to renounce everything. They lay a few other clauses on him, too. But do they kill him? What happens?
Nah, they just kind of, like, do the 1600s equivalent of like the old ankle bracelet, you know, where you can't leave the house.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
He is on permanent timeout. He gets put on house arrest for the rest of his life.
Yeah. And I think they ban his work outright.
Mm-hmm.
Like any of it. Is that right?
Publication of anything he wrote was forbidden, including anything that he might write in the future.
But of course, you know, as smart people are often able to do, he persevered and did continue to write. He figured out how to do it.
Yeah, yeah. And you have to wonder, is that a fate worse than death, to be so smart and so enterprising and be told that we're not going to kill you, but you cannot do the one thing that gave your life meaning?
I know. It makes me think of the really amazing scene in the Tonya Harding movie, which I really recommend if you guys haven't seen
Tonya,
where she, the judge, passes down the sentence. This isn't a spoiler because this was in the news, you know, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think we're good here.
Yeah.
And the judge says, you're not going to go to jail, but you can't skate professionally anymore ever again. You can't compete. And she's just like in tears and is like, you know, her conspirators or whatever, they got jail time. She's like, just send me to jail. Just don't.
If
I can't skate, what's the point? You know?
Yeah.
This is, yeah.
But as you said, Noel, he does remain in the historical record. And the mark he left on the human effort to understand the world and the universe around us remains profound and crucial today.
We didn't even talk about his book, The Starry Messenger, where using his prototype for the modern day telescope, he was able to observe celestial bodies and write things down about them before, I believe, anybody else.
Wow. Yeah, that's fantastic. We could do an entire series of shows on the historical significance of Galileo. It's kind of a shame that we have to move on.
It really is, but we're moving on to some equally fascinating territory.
This may well be the most infamous book on our list, or the most well-known by, you know, the average Jane Joe walking around.
For sure.
It is On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. Can we get a crazy sound cue drop?
Charles Darwin.
Perfect. Yeah. Charles Darwin.
Charles Darwin. Charlie D., as I like to call him.
Yeah, to his friends.
Yeah, yeah. He was a fascinating character.
So what did his book ultimately argue, Noel?
Well, at the crux of its argument was a little thing called evolution. Which is not the most palatable thing to certain folks of certain religious persuasions, in the same way that Galileo's ideas challenged these views. This challenged a lot as well in terms of, you know, if we evolved from other more lower species, then we were not made in God's image. Adam and Eve is out the window. Mm-hmm. A lot of things kind of go out the window when you start to buy into his findings.
Right. We see again an analog here, or a similar theme, as we saw in the books by Galileo, because the heliocentric argument is a bit of a kick or a bruise to the ego of the human species. And in a way, the On the Origin of Species is also a kick to humanity, because it's saying you are not this singular thing that was made out of whole cloth. You are the result of a process that was here before you and will function long after you were gone.
It's very true, Ben. And just a quick little summary of Charlie.
Yeah.
He was a naturalist, a biologist, a geologist, very, very versatile man in his learnedness. And he believed that all species of life evolved or descended from a common ancestor, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was that common ancestor for man?
Oh, the primates.
The primates, right?
Yeah.
All right. And so like we said before, this was not met with the most open arms from religious leaders. And this is a thing that still goes on today. So let's just talk about like how this work was received when it came out and what may have led to the idea of it being a banned book. And then we'll kind of bring it to modern day.
Sure. Here we go. So first, it's important to know that Darwin himself identified agnostic, meaning that he was not a fervent practitioner of any particular religion, especially, you know, Christianity, which would have been very common in his time. Darwin was considered a pretty affable country gentleman, country gentry, and he shocked Victorian society at the time when he suggested that animals and humans came from a common source.
Pearls were clutched.
Right, right. This, it wasn't universally hated, it was just controversial because there was at the time also a rising class of professional scientists. It was their job to conduct experiments, right, to be a chemist or a physicist or so on. And this concept, this non-religious biology, appealed to them and they propagated it, but at the same time, very powerful people are powerfully offended.
As powerful people tend to get, their offense has legs. It reaches outward. It can ruin lives. It can topple empires and suppress information.
Right. So let's look at the timeline. He publishes the book in 1859, and it outlines the theory of evolution. Not long after that, the book is banned, particularly in the library of Trinity College, Cambridge, where he had been a student. So the banning begins soon after the book is published, and it inspires international debate. The Church of England reacted against the book, but interestingly enough, Anglicans supported Darwin's theory of natural selection and saw it as an instrument of God's design. So they were saying, okay, evolution can happen because God wants it to.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. That's a very adaptable view. I guess I can appreciate that. But Darwin's research only got more controversial as time went on, and it started to become a concern in public schools.
Ooh, yes. And this is what's nice about this being second in our list here is Galileo may feel like ancient history to some people, right? Charles Darwin may feel a little bit older too, because the book is in, you know, the mid-1800s, but the controversy didn't like die down in 1900 or something.
Oh, no.
It continued for a long time, and it continued, especially here in the United States.
Even though, much like global warming is largely accepted by the scientific community, Darwin's teachings were as well. And the idea of evolution and natural selection is sort of the law of the land as far as the science crowd goes. So, as one would expect, this ends up in a lot of books, a lot of textbooks that students are getting in high schools and middle schools about biology and the origin of life. And that rubbed certain local governments the wrong way.
Yeah, no kidding. And the way that they would phrase this opposition was relatively fluid. There would be, you know, some of the initial opposition was that this was essentially heresy, which you can't prosecute people for heresy.
Yeah, we don't have a Spanish Inquisition anymore.
Right. So that argument was pretty much on the level, transparent. This offends our view of the nature of the universe.
That's right.
And people rallied behind this cause. It became something that would be portrayed in pop culture as well.
Yeah, big time. Have you heard of the Scopes monkey trial, Ben?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
What do you know about the Scopes trials?
The Scopes trials took place in Tennessee, right?
I think so, yeah.
And it was a... there are some twists and turns you'll hear to the story, but the quick summary is that this was almost like a public trial for whether or not evolution should be taught in United States public schools.
That's right. In fact, they had a law on the books in 1925 that was called the Butler Act, HB 185. It was the bill that was founded on the arrest of John Scopes, who was a teacher in a Tennessee public school, and he took it upon himself to teach evolution. And that did not sit well with the Tennessee government.
And a lot of people rallied behind this because this was the first trial to be broadcast on the radio.
Yeah, the language of the law was no joke either. It was described as, quote, an act prohibiting the teaching of the evolution theory in all the universities, normals, and other public schools of Tennessee. It prohibited the teaching of any theory that denies the story of the divine creation of man as taught in the Bible, and to teach instead that man has descended from a lower order of animals. Punishments included, any teacher found guilty of the violation of this act shall be guilty of a misdemeanor, and upon conviction shall be fined not less than $100, nor more than $500 for each offense.
Mm-hmm.
Yikes.
Right, and this is in Dayton, Tennessee. And one thing that I find kind of wholesome and lighthearted about the whole event is that there was a carnival-esque atmosphere outside the courthouse. People were selling hot dogs, lemonade, toy monkeys, of course.
Yeah. In fact, there is a pretty amazing little jingle that was written around this very event. Casey, can we have a clip of this, please?
I'm no kin to the monkey, no, no, no. The monkey's no kin to me, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know much about his ancestors, but mine didn't swing from a tree. It seems so unbelievable, and yet they're saying it's true. They're teaching us about it in school now, that humans were monkeys once too. Whoa, I'm no kid.
Ah, sweet, sweet, catchy ignorance.
It is catchy. You have to give it that. Like, if you just heard that song and you didn't speak English, you would think, oh, that's got a nice roll to it.
Well, it's got good alliteration. It's like, I'm no kin to the monkey, no, no, no. The monkey's no kin to me, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like a calypso almost.
Yeah, it's got some punch to it.
Kind of makes me want to deny evolution.
It's working, Noel. It's working. You can't listen to the song in full. They'll get you. But they also technically got Scopes. Interesting fact, he was found guilty, and he was fined $100.
$100. I guess he only did it once.
In the modern parlance, we would say he took an L. He took that L for all of us, though.
Yeah, he really did. But this, you know, this was in 1923, and this stuff was happening as recently as, like, the 90s. In Georgia, for example, there was a Supreme Court ruling that declared it unconstitutional for the government to require biology textbooks that contained natural selection versions of evolution and the origins of life. Mm-hmm. They would have stickers on them that referred to this stuff as a theory. Evolution is a theory, they would say, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. And then in January of 2005, a federal judge ruled that those stickers were no good because they essentially endorsed a religious viewpoint.
And the school board spent a year appealing the ruling until it finally got settled in 2006.
Yeah, man. That's insane. I really like this one. California, of course, California. In 2010, the Supreme Court decided to not hear the Association of Christian Schools International et al. Versus Roman Stearns et al. And this case was an appeal of a ruling that basically said that the state had the right to consider the teachings of certain religious schools insufficient preparation for college.
That's, you know, you've got to respect the way that people frame these things, because supporters of the measures like the sticker thing or the idea of teaching intelligent design hand in hand with evolution in a public school, supporters of these measures say that they are not repressing a view. They are promoting, quote, academic freedom by encouraging students and teachers alike to think critically and pretty much question everything.
That's a bunch of jibber jabber.
I don't know if it is sincere.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like a line of bull honky.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there's a whole stream of hooey. But it does go to show that even after more than 100 years, this book remains controversial. And there are people who will tell you that it is purposefully meant to mislead you, you know?
Sure.
Even now.
And hey, no ding on Christians here. This is just a matter of, to me, ignoring clear evidence in favor of stuff that even many Christians will say that the Bible is a book that is meant to teach. It has these kind of like scenarios that aren't necessarily meant to be read as
literal
factual occurrences.
Yeah.
So I always find it interesting when people are so stuck in an opinion that they can't see that there's, you know, other information out there.
And I'm a fan of the approach that those Anglicans took back in the 1850s, 1860s. Things don't have to be mutually exclusive. You know, your personal belief system is just that, personal.
Yeah.
Right?
Big time.
And so also you have to consider if somebody is an opponent of a scientific thought like this or a theory of some sort, going out of your way to suppress it in this manner makes it so much more powerful and interesting,
of course,
to everyone else, you know?
Yep, agreed.
So thanks to you, Charles Darwin. Thanks for hopping on the Beagle and changing the course of science for us all.
The Regal Beagle?
Yep, the HMS Beagle. Ah, Noel. We're drawing to a close, at least for our massive list of three.
I don't know. I think we've done a good job of expanding it. There have been lists within lists, kind of, you know, sub-lists.
And I have so much other stuff on banning books, I might have to just, like, run through it real quick at the end.
Do it.
If we have time.
Sure.
But what's next?
Oh, man. Well, Casey, I want you to give me your feedback on this. We're going to talk about Georges Lemaître.
That's like George the Master.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Georges Lemaître.
Lemaître. I think I did it okay.
Yeah, I think you did a great job.
Cool.
You got it.
All right. So George. Now I got to really like.
Wait, was this all on mic?
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
I guess so, yeah.
I don't know. It doesn't have to be.
Well, this has been Casey on the Case.
I guess so. It does have to be that. This gentleman, Georges Lemaître, has the most remarkably unremarkable title of any of the books on the list so far. Oh, I love the pants off of it. Would you like to grace us with this title, Ben?
Sure. Get ready. A homogeneous universe of constant mass and growing radius accounting for the radial velocity of extragalactic nebula.
By Georges Lemaître.
I'm telling you, you're nailing that pronunciation. Could you hear, Casey? There was pride.
There was
in his voice.
I mean, that makes me feel really good. So yeah, this gentleman, he wrote this article in 1927. It wasn't a book, and this espoused essentially the first version of what is now referred to as the Big Bang Theory.
Or,
yeah, that one. Yeah, that's the onomatopoeia version of it.
Right, right.
And just to give you a sense of what a giant of astrophysics this guy was, Stephen Hawking basically credits him as being the founder of it all, the godfather of this idea of the universe exploding outward from a particle known as, what is it, a super atom?
Yeah, or a cosmic egg or primeval egg. Is that
right.
The one?
Yeah, that's so cool.
And lest we sound like we're going to be constantly pitting science against spirituality here, we should point out that in addition to being a titan in the world of astrophysics, Lemaître was a Belgian Catholic priest.
He was indeed. Every picture you can find of him, he's got his little, what do you call that thing? A little priest collar?
Yeah, a Roman collar or a clergy collar.
There you go. Yeah. So he is deep in both worlds, my friend. He is a man of science and a man of God, which makes his findings extra interesting to me.
Absolutely. And his religious standing didn't stop the Big Bang from being looked at as a controversial idea. Mm-hmm. Even Albert Einstein at first was like, yeah, you sure about that?
I don't know about that one, buddy.
Yeah, I don't know, Father. And we can, you know, you can kind of understand, just like the case with Galileo or with Darwin.
It was wild.
Yeah, we've never heard this before.
Radical.
But it's such a challenging question that humanity is still trying to really figure out, you know, what did the universe have a starting point? If so, what was there beforehand, you know? And this is mind-blowing stuff that this guy came up with. And sure, we can laugh a little bit at the idea of cosmic egg. It's kind of like Emerson's transparent eyeball, but it's a...
Sounds like a really cool prog rock band.
Cosmic egg?
Yeah.
Oh, we should tell everybody. So we have been collectively, Casey, Noel, and some of our colleagues and I, have collectively been really into making up band names or noting when something would be a good band name. So you're probably going to hear us doing that for a while in the next few episodes. We like to do the band name and then the genre. So cosmic egg.
Yeah, like I would say kind of like krautrock, like sort of like Can, you know?
Yeah.
Like very repetitive drumming and, you know, dubby kind of bass and, yeah. And then like Paul Muti guitars and, yeah, I'm liking that. Cosmic egg. What else you got?
I feel like cosmic egg is definitely the superior of the three names for band name. I think you nailed it. Hole in one.
We had one last night. It was Denim Glut. Remember Denim Glut?
Yeah, Denim Glut. Oh, was it the Rainbow Denim Glut?
No, you were just talking about how, like, you were saying there was a denim surplus.
Yeah.
And they were trying to, like, capitalize on that by selling it at a loss or something like
that to be
a loss leader or something. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's over my head.
But we had a really in-depth discussion off air about denim.
I think we decided that Denim Glut would be kind of an electro, dancey kind of band.
Yeah. Yeah. It had to be, because it would be too on the nose for it to be country music.
I could see, definitely on the nose. I could see Denim Glut opening for Cosmic Egg, though.
Oh, yeah.
Seems like a good bill.
Dance the Night Away.
I love it.
So we'll let you know when we make those things real bands. But in the meantime, we should return to Lemaître. Lemaître.
Pretty good.
You are so much better at that than I am.
It's all about the Lemaître.
Lemaître.
It's the tre, tre.
Lemaître.
It's that. Oh, God. Sorry, guys. I choked a little bit.
It's been a long week.
It has been a long week. Yeah, our Belgian cosmologist and Catholic priest. Let's talk a little bit about how he arrived at this idea.
Ooh, do tell.
Well, let's start from the beginning. He was born in 1894 in Charleroi, Belgium, and from a very early age, he was into both science and religion. He did serve in World War I briefly, and then after that, he decided to get into theoretical physics and, in short order, was ordained. He really knew his path, kind of a split path. But an interesting one, and he really committed to both pretty heartily. By the time he was 31, he became a professor at a Catholic university. And this is interesting, Ben. During World War II, he actually was hurt when his home was accidentally bombed by U.S. Forces.
Oh, friendly fire, huh?
Yeah, that's rough.
And the whole time, he is studying physics himself as this is going on, as his home is being accidentally bombed. In 1927, he discovers a group of solutions to Einstein's field equations of relativity, and the solutions that he finds do not describe a static universe. Instead,
that was the prevailing notion, right?
Right. The universe is just here, That's it.
Mm-hmm.
But his solutions described an expanding universe. At the same time, a few years earlier, another researcher, a Russian named Alexander Friedman, had discovered this too, but they were not in contact with each other. So he brings this, he publishes this report in the same year, 1927, in a little known journal hey Casey, can you,
Yeah, I'm gonna do my best here. That would be the Annales de la Société Scientifique de Bruxelles, something like that.
My man.
Bruxelles, somewhere in there, yeah.
Ah, Casey on the case, ladies and gentlemen.
In this report, he presents this idea of an expanding universe that we would later call Hubble's Law, the idea that the outward speed of distant objects in the universe is proportional to their distance from us. This is pretty crazy stuff, right?
Seems legit.
Seems legit to us now.
Yeah, no, I know.
So we've got a little bit of a pickle here. How did we get from cosmic egg to the Big Bang Theory? There's a story there that it's called Big Bang Theory after a sarcastic remark from an English astronomer named Fred Hoyle in 1949.
It's true. I actually found this article on Christian Today. I guess it's written by a British person because I just love this. They say, one skeptical scientist, Fred Hoyle, rubbished Lemaître's idea as the Big Bang Theory. And even Einstein, we mentioned earlier, thought it was just way too far out, man. I'm Albert Einstein, man, and that's just too far out. That's how he would have
That's
reacted.
How he actually sounded, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
We did the research on that. Yes, so now, fast forward to the modern day, we are very, very fortunate that these ideas and these works survived despite the way they challenged the status quo.
What was it, like the discovery of background radiation or microwaves or something like that, like confirmed a lot of the basis for his argument?
That's correct, Noel. That's true. Actually, a while back, I was able to interview the Nobel Prize-winning professor John Mather, who was instrumental in essentially proving the Big Bang and taking it outside of the realm of theory. And we were interviewing him because he was working on the James Webb Space Telescope, which is
nice.
The successor to the Hubble.
That's right, when you guys went to NASA.
Mm-hmm.
So cool. Yeah, and it was actually a pair of scientists, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson, who discovered those cosmic microwave background radiations. I am not even borderline smart enough to know how that relates or what that means, but Lemaître did find this out before his death, and he sure as crap knew what it meant. So good on him. Vindication.
That's true.
Score one for science.
And you always have to imagine, you know, if we put ourselves back in these people's shoes, it is so fascinating to think how much progress they made with so much less assistance or knowledge in comparison to what we have today.
It's true.
Boy, we can only hope that in 2400 AD or something, people look back and say, I can't believe they made such a great podcast before the days of telepathic communication.
If that's our legacy, then I'm fine with that. Man, I'll tell you, Ben, I'm bushed.
This is a long one.
That was a long one. I sure would hate it if some sort of pedantic supervillain came along.
Don't do it. I had so much great stuff to close out on the dangers of modern censorship, and now we're here.
It's time, gentlemen.
I guess it was only a matter of time before it was once again time.
That's right. Fatalism, it's your friend.
Jonathan Strickland, the Quizster, you've returned yet again, both to challenge our ability to discern true history from fake history and to rationalize all the budget money we spent on that gigantic grandfather clock.
Oh, it's back, huh?
It's always been.
Of course.
I am nothing if not an excuse for extravagant purchases.
You seem like you've kind of taken it down a notch a little bit, Strickland.
I'm going to be honest. In another day, I'm going to be opening up at a show, and all my energy has been devoted to that. So you're kind of getting the, I'm not going to say halfway.
This is Quister on 7.
That's
usually you're on like 13.
6.2.
I'm going to say it can be a bit much.
All right, hang on.
Well, gentlemen, now prepare yourselves. Now, as I understand it, the topic for today's discussion was one on banned books.
Yeah.
Can you go back to 7?
Yeah, why did you ask him to do this?
I'm going to burn through all my energy right now.
You know, Quister, I got to tell you, you've become quite the divisive figure on our show. We only forward you the nice emails.
So there's those who really hate it. Well, you know what? I've always said it's the most cringeworthy segment in podcasting. I make no apologies. So I have for you your scenario. And as, of course, you always know that I always have an arbitrary rule that I instate.
Yes.
In order for you to ask questions during the 3 minutes you have to deliberate.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you that arbitrary rule after I read you the scenario. So you'll get a little extra time to think it over. That little extra time being, you know, the 5 seconds it takes me to tell you the arbitrary rule. So here is your scenario.
All right.
And yes, it's gotten longer. It's just, that's the way I roll. It'll soon be its own podcast. Here we are.
Yeah.
From the mid-1970s through the 1990s, many parts of the world, particularly the United States, were gripped in what we now call the Satanic Panic, in which people became convinced that cults practicing ritualistic abuse were poised to topple our world into chaos. Games like Dungeons and Dragons and music like rock and or roll became targets. One town took this a little bit further. On June 26, 1989, Hartford, Connecticut school board officials made a big show of fighting against the forces of darkness by banning several books. Among them was the Necronomicon. There's only one problem. The Necronomicon does not exist. It was a fictional book created by H.P. Lovecraft in his story The Hound in 1922, but apparently no one from Rhode Island told the good folks of Hartford, Connecticut about this. It took a few months, but those same officials became the laughingstock of New England once word got out and no one ever mentioned the ban again. Your arbitrary rule is that before you can ask any question, you must precede it with Ya Ya Cthulhu Fatagan. Begin the clock.
All right. Ya Ya Cthulhu Fatagan.
All right, go ahead. Bad romance, I like it.
I just wanted to try it. I just wanted to make sure I remembered it. I had to say it once. Sorry, I'm wasting precious
clock's
time.
Clock's ticking.
I'm a big fan of Lady Gaga. It's perfectly fine.
Really? Would they be that foolish? I mean, they probably would.
Ya Ya Cthulhu Fatagan.
Yes, Mr. Bolin.
Is it possible that most of this story is true, but one part of it has changed? And if so, would that render the entire thing false?
If you're asking me, would I make up one detail to make a true story into a false one? I absolutely would do that.
Son of a fish. That's my new family friend.
That's pretty good. No.
Yeah.
That's fun. That rolls right off the tongue.
I'm going to double down. I'm going to say true.
Really?
Yeah, that's okay. So here's the thing, Noel.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still divided because these longer ones tend to be fake if you look back.
Really? Mm. You're trying to pick out a pattern.
You're looking for meta information.
I don't know. I don't think he would tip his hand in that way.
He hates us.
That's what I'm saying. I think he would try to. He's playing those mind games.
So, shoot. Okay. Cthulhu Fatagan.
All right, that's fair good enough.
I'm not a native of Innsmouth or whatever.
Right.
So
you're not so Eldritch.
Right. I'm Eldritch light, at least. So you mentioned Rhode Island.
I did.
How did Rhode Island come into
Lovecraft
play?
Lovecraft was from Rhode Island.
Okay.
Born in Rhode Island, died in Rhode Island.
Went to New York a couple times, and it really screwed with his mind.
Did not like it.
Okay. You know what? I'm going to go with true. What do you think?
Surely our time's up. Are we really do.
We have 1 minute and 1 second.
Oh, cool. Well, I'm gonna think on that. I'm gonna have a good think.
Have a think.
Noel's having a think. How are you doing, Ben?
You know, I've been doing all right, man. We had a really great episode today, and just between us, it's always good to see you, even though it's somewhat adversarial.
No.
No.
Are you saying no to the question or no to me?
I say false.
All right, so we've got another situation. We know how this is always resolved.
Rochambeau, we're going to do 1, 2, 3, shoot.
Mm-hmm.
All right. 1, 2, 3, shoot.
All right, so we have Mr. Bolin's got a rock.
He crushed my scissors.
So we're going with true then.
Yes.
Two ahead, I am.
Ben, you fool!
Two ahead.
I have fun.
Fibbed. I know. Made it up.
The whole thing?
The whole thing.
Wow.
The whole thing. Well, I didn't make up the satanic panic. That actually happened.
That did occur. I'm aware of that. But
was it in the attic, though?
June 26th, by the way, happens to be my birthday.
Oh,
that was the hint I threw in there just to tip it off. Also, you could have. I was prepared for all sorts of questions because there have been books titled The Necronomicon that were just various hoaxes. There's, of course, the infamous Simon edition that was published in the late 1970s, early 1980s, but it only sold about 800,000 copies, so that probably wouldn't have registered enough to be on a banned book.
There's also fan fiction Necronomicon.
Sure, in the early 1980s, that really wasn't such a big thing.
But and I shouldn't have said anything about that pattern that I noticed.
I know.
Especially because now he's probably going to switch it up.
Yeah, I was going to say, I also had other books that were supposedly banned in that same group, in case you asked me that question, which included things like Satanic Verses by Salman Rushdie. That's why I originally had the date set for 1985, but when I put that little detail in, I realized that book wasn't published till 1988, so I had to push it back a little.
You, sir, are a diabolical creature of
so good.
The pit, of the abyss.
Hartford, Connecticut would ban me in an instant.
You're an agent of the dark.
Mm.
Well,
you know what, though?
Yeah.
I had fun, too.
Me, too.
Yeah.
Me, too. Hey, Yogg-Sothoth, what'd you think?
Get out.
That's his noise.
He liked it, too.
That is the Eldritch language that they speak in the mythos. So thank you for coming on again. As always, the things we were required to say, you win the battle but not the war. Mm-hmm. We'll be back.
We'll get you next time, my pretty.
I'll have a really long true one for you next time.
Death is but a
Don't
doorway.
Listen to him.
Time is but a window.
Oh, happy dagger.
What's that quote from Ghostbusters 2?
My liege, madam, legal. To expostulate what majesty should be, why duty is, why day is day, night, night, time is time, were to nothing but to waste night, day, and time.
That's not in Ghostbusters 2.
That's Hamlet. I'm sorry.
Ooh, speaking of that, I just want to brag to everybody. I'm going to see Sleep No More tomorrow night, and
ooh,
I am stoked.
Awesome.
You know about this?
Yeah. I've heard about this.
Yeah. It's like a immersive experience where it's like Macbeth happening in different rooms in this crazy, like, haunted house hotel kind of situation.
There was a similar production that started out in New York and got a lot of buzz.
Hey, don't get too familiar, Quizster.
Oh,
we can't just be talking theater with the Quizster.
I'm shaking my fist at the two of you, and now I'll be away. Bye.
I just want to say that I think he is doing a good job.
Oh, he's doing a great job.
You are not supposed to be hearing that. Okay, I retract. I retract that statement. I do want to end with what I should have said to him. Death is but a door. Time is but a window. I'll be back. Ghostbusters 2, Viggo. It's a great film.
His name is Viggo.
Wife to you and mother to me. Well, will we be able to come back from our crushing defeat today, folks? There's only one way to find out.
Only one way to find out, and that's tuning in. In the meantime, you can write us at ridiculous@howstuffworks.com. You can hit us up on the social medias where we are Ridiculous History on Facebook and Instagram. And, you know, most importantly, join us next week when we talk about how Richard Nixon may or may not have accidentally smuggled a weed for Louis Armstrong.
An illegal weed, the drug, marijuana.
Yes, that's the one. That's the one. But thanks to our super producer, Casey Pegram. Thanks to Alex Williams, who composed our theme. Curses to Jonathan Strickland, the Quizster. And thanks to Brian Young for writing Three Times Society Refused to Accept Books on New Science for HowStuffWorks.com.
And of course, as always, thanks so much to you. We hope that you enjoyed this episode. We hope to hear your take on banned books, as well as the dilemma of progress versus preservation, however you approach that. One last question to end on here that I think is interesting. Are there any books that you feel should be banned, and why?
Fascists. See you next time.